from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In her new book, The Faraway Nearby, San Francisco author Rebecca Solnit contemplates the nature of storytelling and empathy. The author of A Field Guide to Getting Lost and Wanderlust reflects on her mother's Alzheimer's and joins us in studio for the hour ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning, and we welcome you to another hour of the Forum program. This hour, San Francisco-based Rebecca Solnit joins us in studio, author of 12 books, including A Paradise Built in Hell, which we discussed with her on Forum, as well as Wanderlust, A Field Guide to Getting Lost, and the National Book Critics Circle award-winning River of Shadows. She recently published a new collection of essays titled The Faraway Nearby. She is a recipient of the Mark Linton History Prize and a Lannan Literary Award. Her work has appeared in Harper's. She's been a columnist for Salon.com. I also read her in Tom Engelhardt's blog, which I'm going to give a plug for here, Tom.com. And we welcome
TomDispatch.com.
TomDispatch.com. Thank you, Rebecca. Good to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
Lovely to be here.
And I want to talk to you about this new collection. I want to talk to you also about some of the articles in Salon. I hope we can cover all this. But let's talk first about the title. It's a George O'Keefe painting.
Yeah. And I should say, first of all, that I don't consider it a collection of essays. I consider it a unified whole, in discrete pieces. It's 13 chapters that proceed very systematically, but range quite widely. And so that's my interjection.
They are interwoven. That's a good and faithful interjection to your motivations. I thank you for that.
Thank you. But I am willing to answer your questions mostly. The Faraway Nearby is a wonderful phrase George O'Keefe used both as the title for a painting, very unusually because her paintings usually had very kind of simple descriptive titles, but also she would sign letters to friends in other parts of the country when she was living in what was then a very remote New Mexico from the Faraway Nearby. And it really expressed more beautifully than anything else I could come up with, because I tried the ways in which we can be emotionally close but geographically distant, emotionally distant though geographically close, this kind of constant play of warmth and coolness, closeness and distance.
It's a striking painting. It's an animal skull with all kinds of antlers coming out. And I actually read her statement about that beautiful, untouched, lonely-feeling place. That's really what you're describing, isn't it?
That's part of it. But it was also a way to describe, you know, and a lot of the relationships talked about in this book, notably with my mother, just how complex are the operations by which we're empathic and aware and just, you know, notice the people even when they're next to us. And, you know, for example, right now in San Francisco, I'm sure there's somebody who's completely ignoring the person sitting next to them. And there's a bunch of people who are deeply emotionally engaged with Nelson Mandela, who may be, who's in critical condition. And that's the kind of operation we do all the time without thinking about it, feeling so connected to somebody we've never met on another continent and not even feeling anything because we're so disconnected to the person who might even be next to us in bed or, you know, our own child or parent.
Where does writing fit into that with you? I noticed, I think I'm getting a direct quote from Rebecca Solnit, which I really like. Writing is saying to no one and everyone the things that it's not possible to say to someone.
Yeah. You know, this is also a book about writing and about books themselves. It's both a celebration and a kind of forensic investigation of stories and how they work, how we make our lives out of them and how we sometimes destroy our lives with them. And, I'm a kid who like hid out in books and ran away into books from, childhood alienation, but also because I was in love with books. But first when I was just a reader and then in the early stages of being a writer, it felt like this was this very solitary place. And then it's as though that forest of books had another side to it. And most of the people in my life, one way or another, have come to me through through these through writing. And it's, you know, like Tom Engelhart of Tom Dispatch is one of my closest friends, and we're connected by writing. And
he almost didn't read you. I remember that story. Right?
Oh, yes, that's a very funny story. I sent him an unsolicited piece 10 years and a month ago, and he wrote me a brush-off reply. But when I got home, the phone message said, "This is Tom Engelhart. Ignore my email and call me at home immediately." And of course, I had to read the email. But then I called him at home immediately. He wanted to publish the piece. He'd just like given me a rejection letter for without reading it. And we've been kind of fantastic collaborators and friends ever since. And he's the best editor, and he's given me this remarkable space in which to become a kind of writer, a political writer, a person who can write about the, things with a kind of immediacy and in time and in, I think, emotion that I would not have had otherwise. And, you know, it's one of the great highlights of the last decade of my life.
I'm also an admirer of Tom's, and I must say of yours as well, because just the broad range of things that you write about, and Tom is almost a legendary editor in his day, I must say, as well as a novelist. But I just keep getting struck over and over again through the years by the range of things that you write about. Of course, you know, we cover a lot of topics here on Forum, and you're like me, a curious person, and you want to explore all those kinds of things. But this book is much more personal. This is a much more intimate book.
In some ways, and it's a bit more intimate than Field Guide, but Field Guide was actually quite similar. You know, it's got parents and close friends and romances and things in it. But it's funny, when people talk about this book, they seem to forget that, you know, I've kind of done it before.
Well, but not quite in the same way, to be sure. And you're writing about your mother here, and I've came away with a lot of questions about your relationship with your mother. But I want to focus actually on, because so many people go through this caregiving process with elderly parents, and the baby boomers are going to be going through it like nobody's business, as my mother would put it, with respect to just the numbers here. And you talk about your mother being constantly on edge. You being constantly on edge with your mother, waiting for the next crisis because she was a geriatric delinquent on her solo expeditions. Very difficult to care for, but it fell on you. You've got four brothers.
No, I've got three brothers. And two of them were full and deeply committed collaborators on that project, who just did a fantastic job. There was this terrifying moment very early on when I talked to an old guy who sold long-term care insurance. He said, "Well, you're the daughter, and of course it will all be up to you." And that was just scared the daylights out of me. And my mother also thought that.
You're a girl, and you have nothing to do all day, which is how you say she saw a writer's job, I guess.
Yeah. But my brothers were great. I was not a solo caregiver. Yeah, and
was it more on you, though? I got that impression.
Well, as far as my mother, you know, there was this long period, actually most of my life, when my mother hid, you know, both sort of the dark side of her persona and medical crises and things from them, and would call me about everything. And the line you mentioned was, because at one point, you know, years into her calling me with all these emergencies related to losing her keys in her car and getting locked out and confused and wanting help with things, I said, "How come you always call me?" And she said, "Well, you're the girl, and you're just sitting at home doing nothing all day anyway," which, for, you know, as I'd written about 10 books at that point, that wasn't really how I thought of myself. But she really did have this, although she had been an ardent feminist in many ways, did have this deep-seated belief that I was there to be her caregiver, and maybe that she was there to be my brother's caregiver, which wasn't really a great chain of being I had signed up for or supported.
Well, you write about 100 pounds of apricots falling into your lap. That becomes kind of the central metaphor when you talk about how the essays, the pieces are interwoven. That's part of it in terms of storytelling as well. And I was struck by your excursion early on in talking to your mother about fairy tales. I was reminded of Bettelheim's book, actually. I don't know if you're familiar with it, where he talks about the uses of enchantment and how fairy tales will take us into like a scary place, Hansel and Gretel, let's say, and then take children into that and then bring them out and restore kind of order at the end. So it's happily ever after. And, you know, what you're writing about with your mother is a struggle. There's no happily ever after there. It's an ongoing dementia that children have to face when their parents age.
Yeah. You know, there's various kinds of happily ever after. And in one sense, one of the things that I really understood more directly through writing this book is that my mother wasn't really enraged at me. She was sort of, you know, set afire by all these stories. She was kind of haunted and bedeviled by stories about what a woman should be, what a family should be, what a daughter should give her, what beauty is, why she should have more, why I should have less, although she was quite a beautiful woman. And so she just was kind of devoured by these stories. And that was where most of her wrath at me came from, maybe all of it. And then there was this really interesting moment when she suddenly lost all her stories. And after like a third of a century of her essentially prosecuting a one-way war against me, I would walk into the room and she'd just light up with joy and adore me. So, and it was so interesting. There's a real sense on the part of a lot of writers that stories are the most wonderful thing ever. I just heard Eduardo Galeano say the world is made out of stories as though that's a good thing. But we all know there are stories about racial inferiority and American exceptionalism and what men are supposed to be that really confine men and what women are supposed to be. And
stories, you know, that haunt us for lifetimes. And stories, as you say, that lead us to death and suicide. And so on.
No, stories are, you know, people are so, you know, kind of saddled and imprisoned and poisoned by stories of why they're worthless, why they're ugly, why nobody will ever love them, why they'll never succeed, why their tremendous success is really hollow. This is not to advocate for terminal brain disorders at all, but sometimes losing your stories is great. And what I'm really interested in is when, you know, before terminal brain diseases, when we learn to pause our stories, to become the teller of our stories rather than people who just have stories pile up on us that tell us what to do. And that's one of the central questions of the book. We think we tell stories, but stories tell us.
Or the stories are told to us and we accept them and we buy them and we feel we're owning them and we're not owning them. But also, I found myself just getting into this whole circuitry of yours about stories and narrations and fairy tales. And, you know, you've even got Frankenstein, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, interwoven as
of
well.
Of course,
as,
I do.
But I kept thinking about, you know, the fictional stories we tell ourselves too. I mean, and the unreal stories, as opposed to being able to actually tell ourselves unvarnished stories or real stories. I mean, in many respects, it's almost as if, especially when you're writing memoir, you know, you find yourself conflating memoir sometimes with your imagination and not necessarily being able to separate the two. And so the stories we tell ourselves are often, frankly, false stories, or they're stories of what Jean-Paul Sartre would call bad faith stories, where we're not necessarily being authentic to ourselves.
And being authentic to yourself, I think, should be everyone's goal, but nobody actually arrives there. You just get closer and further. But yeah, there's a real sense in the way a lot of people talk, as though some of us, you know, we know what crazy is and it's completely separate from what we are, which is sane, and that there's people who are dishonest and we're completely separate from that. Or there are people who are losing their memories, but we're not like that. And it's all a matter of degree. And very early in the book, I write about, you know, that apricot tree where the 100 pounds of apricots that launched the book, which in a way is just an exegesis of, you know, all the possibilities and meanings and problems of 100 pounds of apricots on your bedroom floor. But there's a
real...
used
to be used for cancer cures.
I think that was Laetril in the 70s. But, you know, but there is this sense in which all of us forget things. And I thought I remembered a picture of me actually standing in that tree with pruning shears. And then I went back and looked at the photographs. There's one of me standing in on a ladder, but it's actually my little brother in the tree with pruning shears. Nobody's memory is completely reliable. None of us are entirely trustworthy, and I don't think any of us are completely sane. So this is, you know, why I try and write with a sense of degrees of like how productive or constructive are our stories, rather than is this true? Is this a lie? Et cetera.
Remember the writer Jerzy Kosinski?
I do.
You know, he said that memory essentially accommodates feelings, that we edit our memories like, say, a film editor almost, and we reshape them as we go on in our lives to accommodate where we are at that point in our lives, or to accommodate really our emotions. Yeah.
Some more than others. You know, I was trained as a journalist with an enormous ethical commitment to accuracy. That doesn't mean that my mind is more reliable than the next person's, but I work hard at corroboration and sort of trying to stand back from my own motivation and trying to see other perspectives on things when I'm narrating a particularly a personal story. And, you know, part of I spent my whole life trying to understand my mother in some sense, and who was so driven by these stories.
Actually, since you brought up the stories that you have to tell, I was struck in reading, we'll get back to your mother and your book in a moment. And by the way, we're talking with Rebecca Sultan. Her new book is, and she's the author of River of Shadow, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award. Her new book is called The Far Away Nearby. A piece you did, you know, you've written for Salon for quite some time. And David,
oh, those are all Tom dispatches that Salon picks up.
Well, David Talbot was on here, and I thought I saw it, maybe it was coincidental, maybe not, but the attitudes were very similar about that you were expressing in your own storytelling and that he was expressing about what's happening to San Francisco and the same kind of anxiety about it being sort of yuppified or taken over by the forces of Silicon Valley and the values of Silicon Valley. And you really really hit hard on that question about what can we do? What will stop Google? But also on some of the individuals who are identified, you know, the used to be called in another day the barons of one sort or another. I mean, Zuckerberg and what's his name? The one who threw the huge
Sean
wedding.
Parker. Yeah, Sean Parker,
and
Zuckerberg.
Really, you know, talking about the
Larry
crassness
Ellison.
Of Larry Ellison. I mean, these are easy targets in some way, but they're targets that show a kind of narration and a story about what you feel is toxic.
Yeah, you know, I think a huge number of us are really distressed by the boom coming out of Silicon Valley, which is putting enormous pressure on everyone else as housing becomes more and more unavailable and unaffordable. I know a lot of people who are being evicted. And I see San Francisco as a complex ecosystem with nurses and artists and firefighters and day laborers and school teachers and all, you know, and of course it's been a very expensive city for a long time, but as it gets more and more so, particularly, and Silicon Valley's mostly youngish white guys, and the homogeneity of that, you know, does not, I don't think, is particularly good for the city. And so that's one thing. And then there's two other things to consider. One, another is like, what is the culture there? And the culture is this kind of loopy libertarianism. One of the recent books on Silicon Valley, the author says that more than once he's had these billionaires say that we should privatize the streets to them. And that is so antithetical to democracy, to the First Amendment, to any sense of freedom and shared in community and public life. And it's like Thatcherism on crack. And then the last thing is, what is Silicon Valley doing? The recent revelations about the NSA, the fact that they have all your data and or
Google has
your
all
metadata.
Our data.
yeah. And, you know, like suddenly most of our information is being controlled by these absolutely unaccountable people who want us to have absolute transparency and want to retain absolute secrecy themselves. And that's as true of something like Google as it is of something like the National Security Administration. So, you know, here's this new culture with tremendous global power arising in our backyard, or maybe we're in their backyard at this point. It's also interesting because, you know, I've written a bunch of histories and read a lot more histories of California and San Francisco. I think one of the beautiful things about this place is it's always been an edge. You know, it was the far edge of Western civilization, the far edge of the country, always a place that was alternative and different, where new things arose and kind of dissident versions arose, a sanctuary for undocumented immigrants and war resistors and queer people and things. And now we're a global center. And people usually think that being a center is great because money and power go with it. But I'm not so sure that centers are beautiful, wonderful things.
You're talking about a kind of, San Francisco and all its bohemianism and attracting dissidents, as you say, and so forth. This is almost an anti-force to that, as you see it, at least as I read you, talking about Google as becoming an empire. Well, it is an empire, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's something that, you know, until very recently, nobody was talking about. And Google's looking to monopolize all mapping, most communications, search and, you know, all searches, et cetera, while, you know, email, et cetera, while holding all your data acquired from that and using it to sell you. They don't sell advertising. They don't sell products to you. They sell you to advertisers. And that's where most of their revenue comes from. And it's really, it's pretty scary. And In the piece for Tom Dispatch, I said, imagine it's 1913 and the post office, the map-making operations, the phone company, and movie theaters, because they also own YouTube, you know, and a host of other things are all owned by one shadowy corporation. Well, jump forward a century and see, like, that's actually where we live now. I don't like consolidation. And I don't trust, you know, these people are so young and so rich. I don't think they know very much about the world. And
There were Tom Wolfe called Masters of the Universe, remember?
Oh, yeah, that being a master of the universe does not make you a particularly
worldly.
Yeah.
Master of all and master of none.
Yeah.
Again, our guest is Rebecca Solnit this hour. We're talking about lots of things, including her new book, The Faraway Nearby, which is a title from a painting by George O'Keefe. And by the way, this is just my own strange curiosity because, you know, I'm interested in pop culture. Did I read something about Beyonce's kid being named because of Blue Ivy? I mean, it's Blue Ivy, I guess, because
of... Yeah, Blue Ivy Carter. Yeah, that's just about a year ago, Beyonce tweeted two paragraphs from A Field Guide to Getting Lost, a sort of rhapsody on the color blue. And that's all she did. She didn't offer any explanation, comment, etc. But apparently, if you're Beyonce, the world loves to interpret the hell out of anything you do. And so everybody leapt to the conclusion that she was giving the big clue to why she named her baby Blue. And, you know, I'll take it. But as I said, I was trained as a journalist. I saw that first all these things about, like, Rebecca Solnit is why, you know, inspired her to name her baby. And then I did what a journalist is, which is I said, do we have a primary source? Do we have an actual attribution? And we don't. So I have been tweeted by Beyonce. I doubt I have anything to do with her baby's name.
Well, you work like a journalist, but you also come out with some strong statements and controversial statements. I think you said about Ralph Nader, he's a clown and he should go away. Am I quoting you correctly?
I don't know if I don't remember saying anything exactly like that, but I, you know, during this last election, I really started to think what it would have been like if, and I don't think it's solely Ralph Nader's or even largely Ralph Nader's fault that George Bush stole the presidential election in 2000 rather than winning it. Exactly. But, you know, thinking about climate, I got very nostalgic for the Gore presidency. And, you know...
You should have been trying to referee a debate between Nader and Neil Ferguson, which I had the strange distinction of doing. But you also come out with... I mean, journalists are supposed to be always equanimity and all that. You come out with some strong statements about... you mentioned the climate movement. You're very positive about the climate movement. You're very positive about Occupy. I mean,
yeah.
And you're a woman of hope in terms of your expository stances in so many instances.
Yeah. Well, you know, I went to the journalism school at UC Berkeley. I like to say I'm a product of the California public education system from kindergarten to graduate school, although I'm not sure everyone considers that a recommendation. And
your case it is. Hold that thought, by the way, about education, because we're coming up on a break. And I want to actually invite listeners to join us in conversation with Rebecca Solnit, her new book again, The Faraway Nearby. There are a number of ways you can do that. And you can call us. Our toll-free number is available to you. If you have something you'd like to bring to the table here to this conversation or you have questions or comments for her, we welcome your calls. It's 866-733-6786. Clearly one of our finest writers who is a San Francisco treasure. And you can talk to her now at 866-733-6786. You can also email us, our email address, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments immediately onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Again, the phone number, 866-733-6786. We'll continue with Rebecca Solnit after this. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In her new book, The Faraway Nearby, San Francisco author Rebecca Solnit contemplates the nature of storytelling and empathy. She's the author of A Field Guide to Getting Lost and Wanderlust, and reflects on many things in this book, as she's known for, author, and also the author of Wanderlust, A History of Walking, and A Field Guide to Getting Lost, as well as A Paradise Built in Hell. And by the way, you can read an excerpt from The Faraway Nearby. It's on our website, kqed.org, and we invite you to do that. We also invite you to join us in conversation with Rebecca Solnit. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Zach writes, I can sum up Silicon Valley with seven words: success theater, competence theater, self-hollowing greed. I like your guest point of view. Another listener tweets, if anybody doesn't have time for Rebecca Solnit, the smartest Californian, you are not my friend or ally. That's pretty strong stuff.
Yeah. I would never say that.
I know you would. You're too modest. But you're talking about the California education. I mean, and people have been singing you your praises, even being compared no less to Susan Sontag, among others, Joan Didion and the like. This is high praise. This is the bar about as high as it can be. And you don't credit your California education as being...
I do. I'm actually quite proud of it. I was on a panel with a couple of East Coast guys who are otherwise lovely. But, you know, they're even older than me, and one of them introduced himself by his Harvard credentials, another one by his Princeton credentials, which is something...
He didn't say he was from Cambridge. That's what Harvard people usually do.
They don't say, I'm from Harvard, or I went to Harvard.
I studied in Cambridge.
Yeah, but it's about a kind of... Those are very... You know, and maybe there are scholarships involved, but those are very expensive elite schools. And I just realized that people kind of name drop things like that, and that I was going to name drop the state universities, the UC system, et cetera. And so I've been using my bio ever since, that from kindergarten to graduate school, with just a few semesters overseas in a private university. I'm a product of the public education system. But that was all prefatory because I was being too long-winded to saying, I went to journalism school at Berkeley, and Ben Bagdikian, wonderful professor who'd been an ombudsman at the Washington Post during Watergate, used to say, you can't be objective, but you can be fair. He was somebody very much in the spirit of Howard Zinn. And I tried to be fair, which is to get my facts straight, but to speak very much from my point of view, which is quite strong, probably quite radical, although I consider it perfectly sane and reasonable.
You speak about those privileged Easterners and who went to the Ivy League schools and everything. I wonder if you feel... Because you've had a lot of success as an author, but many of the authors I know feel a kind of exclusion. Anything west of the Hudson, you know, is somehow not necessarily persona non grata, because there are certainly West Coast writers who are given their due and given a lot of geography in terms of print. But there is a kind of snobbery there, and there is that attitude toward West Coast writers that they shouldn't be taken as seriously.
You know, that was so compelling when I grew up. And I said I went to school overseas. I went to Paris because growing up in the Bay Area, I grew up in Novato mostly. And I was always being told that history and civilization and culture were elsewhere, had happened elsewhere, that California had none. There are famous essays like Edmund Wilson's The Boys in the Back Room that just are so hostile to the idea that there could be major culture out west. I think that's really faded away. One thing is that California is now so powerful that I think they've just kind of gotten over it.
In large part because of Silicon Valley.
That's another side of it. But it's also that I think California used to be kind of like the younger sibling being told by the older one, you're not that smart, you're not important, I'm right about everything, as older siblings sometimes do. And now California is like, I'm grown up, I'm powerful, I don't give a damn what you think because, you know, I am, you know, doing immense cultural things in my own right. And as a writer, a lot of what I've done is write the California histories that and the Western histories that weren't available for me to read, but I felt should have been. But, you know, it's changed
a lot.
Another
name for you, a historian. You are a historian, a kind of lay historian.
I like that, lay historian. Nothing makes me happier than excavating in an archive and piecing together a story. I've spent a lot of incredibly happy hours in the Stanford libraries where...
More fun than the actual writing?
No, not more fun, but it's really being a detective on a trail. And also there's something so magic. Like I once held the manifest for the California Battalion of 1846, which has all these names like Kit Carson and John C. Fremont on it, people who were fighting the war against Mexico. Not that I think that was an honorable war.
No, it was not.
But primary materials, you know, it's all the Shroud of Turin. It's all the Holy Grail. And it's so exciting to piece together some major piece of history, like Edward Muybridge's life and impact. That, you know, the real indigenous history of Yosemite that hasn't really been assembled before. So I was going to say Bancroft as well as Stanford libraries. Bancroft at UC Berkeley have been just such incredibly magical heavens to reside in from time to time. And I have a project a little down the road that will let me spend a lot more time in both.
So this is your idea of paradise. Give us another notion, I mean, just of what excites you or makes you feel paradisical in terms of your work or your life.
You know, I like walking down the street with 10,000 like-minded people, and I like these moments when civil society comes alive and people feel a sense of connection and agency and voice and purpose that's missing from everyday life. A paradise built in hell, and a lot of my political writing is about that. But I like a lot of things. I also like wandering alone or with a couple people in the desert. I like cooking dinner for a dozen people. Playing with my new nephews is like one of the most thrilling things these days. There's one who's 3 months and one who's 3 years. It's a huge amount of pleasures. And I know a lot of writers really hate writing, but I find it incredibly difficult and frustrating at times. But I also have these moments where I just feel like a medium, the words flow through me. And, you know, it's incandescent and epiphanies. I actually love what I do. You know, I make a living thinking and investigating and describing and working with language about the things I think matter most and interest me most deeply. And how magical is that?
It's enviable. Let me go to our callers, and we begin with Michelle. Good morning.
Hi, Rebecca. I worked with you at Art Week in the early 80s. Hello.
Oh, Michelle, are you still in Napa? How lovely to hear from you.
Thanks, yeah. Last time I saw you, we ran into each other at Heathrow. Anyway, I wanted to congratulate you on your impressive career. And I have a question. Have you written any poetry or fiction, or do you stick to nonfiction?
Nonfiction is this funny grab bag term for everything that isn't poetry, fiction, or plays. And it gives me plenty of room to do everything from kind of very terse lyrical things to investigative journalism and political tirades and, you know, in books like The Faraway Nearby. So for now, that's what I'm sticking with. And so lovely to hear from you, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle, for that call. Another caller, Neil, joins us from Foster City. Hi, Neil.
Hi there. So I was just listening to Rebecca, and I was kind of surprised to hear her say that she thinks Silicon Valley is a homogenous young white people's culture. I find in the last 39 years I've seen it evolve into anything but, you know, you see more people of Indian origin, of Chinese origin, from all parts of the world out here. So I'm kind of surprised to hear that that's what she thinks of Silicon Valley.
I think his point's well taken. It is, in fact, there are a lot of people there waiting for their visas.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, they're bringing in engineers who work for less money from Asia. But the demographics of who's at the top, I think it's like 89% of the founders are white, 82% of them are male. And Latinos and African Americans are barely represented in any kind of white collar and higher up positions there. And it's very, very, very male. And they really highlight the women who succeed in Silicon Valley, but they are anomalies.
Let me thank the caller. Have you read Sheryl Sandberg by any chance?
Nope.
Okay. Just curious to get your read on her if you had.
Yeah.
The book has become a phenomenon.
Yeah.
Here's a listener who writes, speaking of Western writers, what does Miss Solnit think of Wallace Stegner, and is she a fan of Willa Cather at all?
Oh, I just picked up Willa Cather's new collection of Willa Cather's letters yesterday. I love Willa Cather so much. Even to hear her name is delightful. She's sort of the great prairie writer. And there's just a quality of description, a quality of prose, and also this quality of a woman who led a very strong independent life starting in the 19th century that, you know, she's one of the people like Georgia O'Keeffe who led this kind of powerful Western feminist life.
And probably also a lesbian life, although at the time it was almost unheralded to be open about it. But she was also not just a prairie writer. I mean, she lived and taught in Pittsburgh and wrote about those
experiences. Yeah, and she wrote about Canada and things like that. Yeah. But the books I love are, you know, Death Comes to the Archbishop and My Antonia and things like that. But, you know, Wallace Stegner I really admire for his work and nonfiction with the Sierra Club and things like that. But Willa Cather, I truly, truly love. And, Mary Austin would be the other writer, but her work is so much slighter than Cather's monumental achievement.
Another listener, Mildred, writes, thank you for your comments on the housing crisis and changing demographics of San Francisco. As an artist living in this area, I'm in constant fear of losing my space or rent rising and becoming too expensive to remain in. Thank you.
You know, I was in New Orleans last year. I was supposed to meet with someone, and we got word that she'd been wouldn't be able to meet with us that weekend because she'd been evicted. Of course, I'm a San Franciscan. Like, you know, like fear clutched at my heart. I felt terrible, etc. And then I realized that you get evicted in New Orleans. Yeah, then you go find another house, maybe in some place you always wanted to live for about the same amount of money, no big deal. And I realized how special our circumstances are. People live in terror of losing their houses. They cling to their rent-controlled or roommate situations for decades because there's no place to go easily if you lose it. And I've seen poets and filmmakers and photographers be evicted in the last year, and it has been really scary and traumatic for them. And I think for a lot of us with a sense of, like, where's the culture going? I know a lot of it's going to Oakland, which is booming, but also driving out a lot of the poor people as these refugees from San Francisco move in. But, you know, I fear for the culture.
Let me bring another caller. David from Sacramento, good morning. You're on Forum.
Good morning. Rebecca, you're just so brilliant. I had to ask a question. I've been facilitating the General Assembly at Sacramento for about a year and a half, and we've working on Occupy 2.0, and part of it is moving beyond protest and dissent to a kind of future forum. Where do we go from here? And one of the things that was that we're struggling with is my feeling that essentially the plutocracy has been accomplished. We're living in the 21st century plutocracy, and unless we grapple with that, all the symptoms are just distractions from the core. And I wondered, what's your opinion? How do we deal with that core issue?
And what do you see as the core issue?
Plutocratic hegemony, I think, is what he's talking about here. How do we extricate ourselves from plutocracy? Is that right? Is that accurate, David?
Basically, yes. Yeah. I mean, it's been accomplished. Where does the progressive mind go from here?
Oh, I am not an oracle. I don't have a clear answer to that. I am really excited and a bit hopeful to see how much clearer and more critical the analysis is of Wall Street, of the plutocrats, of the economic injustice in our society, and how much that's changed since 2008. And Occupy has played a big role in it, looking at the way so many Americans' lives are destroyed by debt, medical debt, housing debt, student loan debt, and really redressing it with a few voices like Elizabeth Warren on the inside and a lot of voices on the outside. We're also in this extraordinary moment of civil society and popular unrest. You know, they say the demonstrations in Egypt right now may be the biggest ever in the world, with like 33 million people in the streets at a time. And there's something that I'm still trying to figure out, but we are in this age of popular resistance. It almost feels like a new polarization that between us and them, and even as the Obama administration kind of moves into this shadowy, unaccountable world of, you know, attempted total information control and other kinds of control, and as the public moves into defiance of that and insistence on direct democracy and participatory culture of various kinds. You know, I don't know.
But if the public security is threatened, it may obviously move cataclysmically the other way. I think
you mean that they may shut down our rights.
Well, you know, you have these polls, and people, particularly in the wake of or in the threat of a possible kind of 9/11 or something on that scale, somehow one's concern over privacy suddenly becomes much more abrogated.
I don't. You know, there was such a psychotic propaganda moment post 9/11 where people, a lot of, including the mainstream media and the politicians, really got on board for burning up the Bill of Rights and handing over a lot of our privacy and freedoms. And there were some great outliers, like public librarians, who were so valiant in refusing to give up our records to the Bush administration. So, you know, I don't know. I think people have gotten a little more distrustful and independent. I don't know if we'll have another propaganda moment like that. I also hope we continue talking about how tiny terrorism is on the list of threats we face, and, you know, climate change and weather disasters, poverty, gun violence, domestic violence, you know, the list of things that concern me you know, terrorism would be just so far down the list. And you just look at the statistics of 1,200 women killed a year by domestic violence, of, you know, the number of people dying in these weather disasters and the billions of dollars of losses, of the real instability we're facing globally because of climate. And, you know, and then another way to look at it is, there's a real tendency on the part of the authorities to believe that in the turbulence of a disaster, terrorist incident, natural disaster, famine, etc., that we all become savage Hobbesian brutes who will need to be subdued by the military. That's part of why they're trying to look at all the patterns of our communications and stuff
book.
Now. But yeah, but A Paradise Built in Hell, I looked at the best research on what happens in crisis, and actually most people are calm, resourceful, altruistic, deeply collaborative, and communitarian. And I think that's actually what scares them, because then people start to say, like, look, we can do it for ourselves. This is, we have found our power, and this is the world we want to live in. And no, we're not going back to the world that you guys were in control of.
The horror and tragedy that followed the Boston Marathon, one of the great ironies to me was, with all this metadata collecting and supposedly knowing phone calls that were made, somebody didn't notice, I guess, that calls were being made to Chechnya, or didn't get a track on this. I mean, there's the kind of problem, it seems to me, that's ubiquitous whenever you look at attempts to try to cover all the bases in the name of security. But you're getting some blowback on Google. Let me just read this to you. A listener says, I'm appalled at this woman's ignorance and willingness to generalize about the people at Google. Not everyone is young. You're rich, and I've never met a more worldly group of people than those at Google.
I think a lot of the people at Google are lovely and wonderful, and I gave a talk there last year and met some of them. They're also really smart people, and they're not that different than my friends. I have friends who've worked at Apple and things like that. What I'm really talking about is the direction of the company. You know, there are lovely people working at lots of things that I'm not wildly enthused about, like the Pentagon, and I wasn't talking about who Google employees are, and clearly the direction of the company is not being voted on by, you know, however many thousands of employees. It's not a workers' cooperative, last time I checked. It's, you know, headed by some incredibly powerful billionaires who are seeking to monopolize control of some of the crucial information technology of our day. And
we had Eric Schmidt on, who used to be CEO of Google recently, now is chairman, and do no evil and all that, and we're not out after finding out about your private life. Of course, the government can say the same thing too, but here's Stephen, who says, I feel like Rebecca's take on Silicon Valley is much too harsh. Most of these companies have developed services that are incredibly useful and completely voluntary. They treat their workers very well, and many of those who developed great wealth have used that to take on major world problems, such as ending disease and poverty. The NSA privacy issue is something they are required by the government to do, not on their own. And yes, there are other negative side effects, such as increased housing prices, but these should be addressable by intelligent policy.
I'm not sure how optional communications technology is at this point. You know, somebody who decides they're not going to use search engines and the internet and email, et cetera, is not really going to be able to function very well in this culture. You know, things like Facebook are a bit more optional, but, we're enmeshed in it, and it's not our job to opt out. It's a collective job to make it more accountable, I think. And, I'm not seeing, and it sounds like the person is talking about Bill Gates up in Seattle, who has committed to giving a lot of his fortune away, some of it in very scary ways, like pushing GMO foods on Africa and crops on Africa. And, you know, we're not in a golden age of philanthropy in the Bay
Area. Why is that scary? Because people are being fed who are starving, aren't they?
You know, GMO crops are proprietary property of Monsanto, and essentially it makes farmers dependent on an American corporation interested primarily in profit, and that's the economic angle. Rather,
you're feeding people. Saving them from being starved to death.
You know, there are much better ways to do it, and then, you know, that Monsanto insists that they own the seeds and you have to pay them every time you use them. They sue farmers who try and save seeds from the previous
Monsanto's an easy villain, but so for that matter is Thomas Mugabe, the head of Zimbabwe, who would not take that food on the basis of the sort of argument that it's bad for us to be reliant on corporations, and people went on starving. I don't know. This is a whole other subject.
Yeah, no, that's a huge subject. You know, why, you know, and of course, the bigger picture for Africa is climate change is going to devastate a lot of, is already creating mass famine and mass population migration. And that's something I'm interested in seeing a lot more done about. Although I work with 350.org, which has done
Bill
astonishing things.
Yeah,
well, it's Bill McKibben and a lot of other people.
Well, he's been kind of the main spokesperson.
He's
been on the show representing them.
No, and he's a friend and he's fabulous, but there's more to it than that. And they, one of the astonishing things about the president's speech last week was how much of what was said comes directly, you know, about divestment, about cutting fossil fuel subsidies, et cetera, came directly out of 350's work, which shows the president may just be a kind of weather vane, but 350's become a very powerful wind. And
they still didn't exactly back away from the XL pipeline, although he said if there's climate change proof, we will do.
Yeah.
So it was sort of hedging his bets. I'll read one more thing on Silicon Valley. Janelle writes, I wanted to thank your guest today for highlighting that large Silicon Valley companies need to have accountability for the data they keep. But I found it unfortunate that her views of Silicon Valley workers are mostly young white men. I've been in the industry for 16 years, and a very large percentage of my colleagues are of Asian descent, Indian, Chinese, etc. And many of us are like me, middle-aged and aging. This is another stereotype, in my opinion. I myself am a 42-year-old woman. Another listener says, my first experience reading Ms. Solnit's work was Infinite City, which as a recent transplant to San Francisco was invaluable for me to learn. To inside topologies of the city. I love Rebecca. Mark writes, hello and good morning to you, Michael, and to Rebecca Solnit. I recently picked up Infinite City and I'm enjoying it immensely. I have also recently been reading Gary Brecken's Imperial San Francisco and have the sense that the two are somehow connected and complementary. Does Ms. Solnit have any thoughts on that? Keep up your good work.
You know, not particularly.
Yeah, that's a good enough answer. Let me bring another caller in here. And Mildred, good morning.
Hi, Rebecca. This is Mildred Howard from Berkeley, and you wrote
hey,
about
Mildred.
My work. Hi, quite some time ago, and I miss the criticism of art from you and wondering if you will ever return to that. And thanks for your comments on memory, and I'll take your comments off the air.
All right. Thank you, Mildred. There's a name we ought to bring back into the body politic. Mildred. It's gone.
Mildred.
Like Barbara and Lois and all those names are of another generation, I'm afraid.
And Mildred's a fantastic artist in the Bay Area. He's done some wonderful things. And
you used to write art criticism.
I did. You know, I got it.
When you were a punk rocker, was it?
It's around the same time. I worked at SF MoMA as a grad, San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, as a grad student when I was 21 and 22, and then did art criticism a lot in my 20s. And it was really fantastic training as an essayist, which is essentially what I consider myself. You know, a good review has an introduction, a conclusion, description, and analysis woven together. And the best criticism, the kind I aspire to do, really tries to open things up for the reader rather than kind of nail them down with, like, here's my definitive opinion on. So it's great training, but at a certain point I realized that I didn't really want to write about artists investigating the fundamental things of the world. I wanted to investigate them myself, and the writing was moving more and more in that direction. I still work with a lot of artists, and The Far Away Nearby, the book we're allegedly talking about this morning, although we're all over the map.
You know, there's fun to be all over the map, though?
I am for being all over the map, actually, Michael, but The Far Away Nearby has a lot of visual artists in it, remarkable people like San Francisco's own Ana Teresa Fernandez and Yoko Ono and Anne Chamberlain, the beloved departed artist who did a lot of the public art, great public art in San Francisco. So
you're still there.
Yeah, I'm still there in spirit, but it's not as a critic. I'm still there in my life. A lot of my friends are artists, and I feel like being around visual artists really taught me a lot of my thinking. Visual art asks really big, deep, fundamental questions, and it was a fantastic start. But sorry, Mildred, there's no going back.
You seen the Diebenkorn exhibit yet, which we spoke about just yesterday? Because there's so much of it's all Berkeley years, you know.
Yeah.
The landscapes and the visual pictures of Berkeley, they're either abstract expressionism or representational. There's the whole oscillation in his work between those two is what this whole exhibit is about.
I haven't gotten to see it yet, but I'll be going soon, I hope.
I recommend it. And I'll bring another caller on. Lawrence, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Good morning. Ms. Solnit, I'm a Berkeley graduate myself and a longtime Bay Area resident, and so I'm actually rather embarrassed to confess that I've only just begun to read your work. I'm really delighted with it, and I'm looking forward so much now to making my way back through things that you've been producing for quite a long while. What beautiful prose. I wanted to ask your view concerning a point which I suppose has been expressed by various people, but to me, I tend to associate with the remark of Ernest Hemingway's. Hemingway once wrote, "A writer's job is to tell the truth. His standard of fidelity to the truth should be so high that his invention out of his experience should produce a truer account than anything factual can be. For facts can be observed badly. But when a good writer is creating something, he has time and scope to make of it an absolute truth." I wanted to ask what you think of this notion that fiction can be truer than journalism.
You know, sometimes the times I most understand the urge to write fiction is when I want to describe some kind of emotion or experience untethered from its circumstances and everything that comes from it. But usually I get over those impulses. And there's a kind of truth in fiction. There's another kind in nonfiction. And Hemingway, of course, was writing in an era when nonfiction was not considered to be art, just like photography used to not be considered to be art. And things have, you know, the art schools used to not teach photography. It was considered to have too direct a relationship to reality. And nonfiction was considered when people forgot the fantastic world of essays from Montaigne to Thoreau and beyond, was also considered to be kind of a unloved stepchild. But there's enormous creative scope in what nonfiction does, and it's become a really vital realm, and it does, and it has a kind of weight. And if I tell you about something that actually happened in the world, it's very different than something in a novel.
Leave you with a quick thought here, because we're coming up on the end of the hour. Unfortunately, Cynthia Ozick, when she was on, was talking about how she writes essays, and they can be tentative because they can change in point of view and position and so forth, but fiction forever. So there you have. I don't know, I'm a great believer in fiction's truth-telling, and also a great believer in your work. Thank you so much. Always fun to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you.
The new book, The Faraway Nearby, and you can read an excerpt of it on our website. Thank you for being with us for these 2 hours. For all of us here, have a happy Independence Day. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and the Sue Ann Gershenson Trust.